Accession number 20473, Reel 5.
Lend on reel 5.
Right. Well, in Enschede, we stayed in Enschede for, oh, I don't know exactly wrong, probably just a week or 10 days, something like that, waiting to see what the next move was. And then we ordered to put explosives. We had explosives. We met at the main party come up, and we got loads of TNT put into the lorries. And we proceeded then, and we went across the Bailey Bridge, another bridge that was left standing. Of course, a lot of people don't know that it didn't stand very long, it fell down anyway. But I put a Bailey Bridge across, and we went across that Bailey Bridge and into Germany. And the first night in Germany was rather amusing, really, because we'd had these lectures from these army politicos or whatever they were. We went, everyone was a bit jumpy about going to Germany, and we got in there after dark. Well, by the time we over the bridge, that was after dark, and as I say, all people who were navigating weren't all that clever. Anyway, we used to sleep on a night anywhere we could. We never took buildings over, anything like that. The army did, but we never did, because I don't think the naval officers didn't know whether they had that power or not to, you know, to check over barns and things like that. So we used to sleep anywhere. And this particular night, the first night into Germany, we were going down this, hardly a metal road of sorts, a country road, and we come into a wood. And the staff car turned off into the trees, and we finished up in a clearing in amongst the trees. And put the wagons round, a bit like a circle, it was a bit like the Wild West in that respect. We used to put the wagons round the outside. All's put a guard on a night. And what they used to like to do, our rations, by the way, were very little. They tried to give us one hot meal a day. We used to have those tins of beaten vegetables, M&V. Other than that, we would have tack biscuits and jam. We did have iron rations, we weren't allowed to touch, we'd had chocolate in, but basically that's what we lived on, was tack biscuits, jam, and one meal a day, hot meal a day, stew. And where possible, we used to find somewhere to heat up these meals, but although this was in Germany and the war wasn't finished, we put a fire on, and we were fair distance from the front. They'd moved on pretty quick, the army, at that point. And I was detailed off to do the first watch on the outskirts. So, got us together. See, there was only 80 of us in this party, don't forget, including everybody in this advance party. And told to walk into the wood 20, 30 paces. Then we had a perimeter. There was going to be four people, and they'd have a perimeter around it, you see. So I went in there, and pitch black, trees everywhere, found my way around, and I'm leaning up against this tree, so that's the right bloody place. First night in Germany, and stuck here in a wood. Anyway, that's it. Said, this is a funny tree I'm leaning against, you know. Didn't feel like a tree. Well, we had torches, but we weren't supposed to use them only in emergencies, but the torch, and it was a gravestone, wasn't it? Oh my God. It was a gravestone, so I said, I get away from this quick. So I marched away part of the thing. And part of the way around, there was one of these pickups. And I said, we had to keep our eye out, make sure nobody, keep our eye on the wagons. That was part of our job. So I'm looking through, and suddenly I see a face on the other side. The bloke from the other part of the perimeter had come up. This pickup was about midway between the two of us. And he was looking through, and he put a torch on his face. He said to me, you know, we're in a cemetery, don't you? I said, I guess we were. I said, but there are not many graves here. I said, but it's near all trees. He said, well, I'll tell you what, there is some graves, and some over here. So the officer of the watch never come that night to do rounds. He used to he used to come, usually about every hour he'd come and check. He never turned up anyway. We went off at 12, he hadn't turned up. We had our hammocks with us, funny enough. Most peculiar, we had full army kit, but we had hammocks. And couldn't use them most of the time because I wanted to lay them out on the floor because you've got the bedding in there, you see. But if you had to cut the trees close enough together, that's what we used to sling them between the trees, you're saying. That's what I done this night. Of course, midway, before early morning come on, it poured a rain. Well, what we used to do, get in a hammock, put our waterproof ground sheet, army, you know, used to use as a waterproof, kind of a ground sheet, put that over the top. And of course, the rain filled it all up. It's about drowning you where in your hammock. It was a pretty rough time, it was in them days. But I always remember that because we found out then where we'd gone into was a kind of a chateau type, and then had its own cemetery in the wood. And that's where we finished up. So, first night in Germany, and I'd have to be taught about werewolves, is rather interesting. And after that, we traced around behind the army. We were behind the Royal Marines, actually. The Royal Marines, I don't know whether you know the layout of what happened in Germany. The Canadians went right along the top. They took the ports of Kiel and places like that. Then you had the Royal Marines. Then you had the army units, and then the Yanks. That was basically what it was. So we would be with the Royal Marines. Not with them, but more or less with them. Every now and again, we've seen them. Now and again, we went off track. We got lost. We finished up in the American sector quite a few times, actually. And I'll tell you something that happened there, which maybe you've heard about this, and I don't know. But when we were in the Yankee area, oh, they had quite strict controls of these MPs manning roads and crossroads and all the rest of it, and telling you where to go, where not to go, and where to go and all that. They didn't want to get in the way of the troops moving, troop movement. But this particular day, we pulled out the side, and there was a tank division ahead of us. And they had the tanks in the fields or off the road, what have you. And all the Yanks were sitting there, chewing the fat. They used to take the makeup, as I said, matlows with naval hats on, you know, in khaki with naval hats on. But anyway, get over, move over. The infantry are coming through. And the infantry did come through. And they were all black. And now, I didn't know whether this happened all the time, but it certainly pushed the infantry forward before the tanks very often, and they were they were black, all of them. And the abuse they give to those chaps, incredible.
You mean verbal abuse?
Oh, yeah. Abuse, yes. Yanks call them all sorts, and these poor sods were going ahead. But have you ever come across this before, this? You know,
did the blacks respond?
Well, in one way, yes, but really speaking, they were very much cowed, weren't they, in them days. Even when I was a career and I come across them in the Navy, they were very much cowed in that respect. Anyway, that was just one little thing I'd seen happen. But we come across another part where there was smoke coming out of a wood, and the Yanks had used flamethrowers in the wood, and the German snipers and all that was stuck to the trees, weren't they? All black where they'd bent the wood through. They were pretty vicious. They didn't mess around, the Americans. But anyway, we finished up at a place called Harburg. Now, Harburg was opposite Hamburg, it's on the other side of the Elbe. It was funny enough, it was the German naval headquarters, Harburg. And the Marines were ahead of us. They went through these barracks and these buildings with the big boots and everything else. Anything they couldn't carry, they smashed. Typewriters and all that, everything was smashed when I went through. And when we got there, they'd carried on. Well, I don't know what the situation in the war at that time was. It was near the finish. And they were pushing the troops as far forward as possible, presumably to keep the Russians the other side of the Elbe. That was the whole idea. So all the troops had disappeared. And we were in Harburg waiting to find out what the next move was. We were supposed to go into Hamburg, take over the dockyard, and get it ready to bring ships in, because the line of communication was sort of a stretch. I think Amsterdam or something like that was the nearest port that was actually in use for the army, and we were going to get Hamburg underway, and if necessary, well, fight for it. Simple as that. We had to check the dockyard and get it underway. Not that we could have done much fighting, but still. Anyway, we were in a harbour, and there was a big generating plant there, and it supplied all the electricity for the Amberg dockyard the other side, and probably part of Amberg as well. It was a big, big, very big generating plant, and we were ordered to look after this, to guard it. Now, it was still running, and the German workers were still working in there. Wasn't all that many, actually, but there was, who were there. And I had a chat with them while we were there, and why are you still doing this? Well, what else have we got to do? That was their attitude, but they were still keeping this generating plant going. And we stayed there until Hamburg was made into an open city. All the troops and German troops come out, and we went in. So we went in the first day. We went in, and our skipper, we went down near the Rathaus, and there was a few, I think it was half a battalion, something like that, Royal Welsh. We all met in the square there, and I don't know what, they went inside the buildings, we were there for quite some several hours, while we were all in the square waiting to see what was going on, and what we were told was that they'd just taken the surrender of Schleswig-Holstein from Admiral Dönitz. Rather interesting, that, because you don't hear that mentioned in the normal writers. You always talk about the on the big armistice that was afterwards on the I get the name of the place on the big plane there. But anyway,
Lüneburg.
That's right. Yeah. Anyway, we then proceeded, and funny enough, we knew exactly. We knew, surprising how much we knew about Amberg. Well, we went down to the dockyard and took over Navy House. That was about the only building standing in the dockyard. And I mean that literally. Everything else was, it was a terrible mess. And it had German, a number of them were, I think they were U-boat crews, who were, a lot of them had walking sticks and whatever they were in there. We slung them all out and took over in that. We took over and they left about half a dozen of us to look after it and do guard duties on it, on this building. The remainder went up into town and took over the Reichshof Hotel, which was also standing, dead opposite off Bahnhof Station. They knew all these places were actually standing, were existed. Then the remainder went up to a place called Alsterdorf, which was part of Amberg, and they took over a Panzer Division barracks there. There was two big barracks together. They took that over. And before the main party come up. So I was in Navy House, that's down the Reeperbahn, actually, around that area. Have you been to Amberg?
I have.
There's a big statue of Bismarck. Has it still got the bullet marks on it? They used to fire at it from where we were. That's how, where we were. We could actually fire a rifle in it, at the statue there, Bismarck. But of course, there was no troops in there at that time. Only, I think there was a few Royal Welsh, that was all. There was a few engineers. I don't know whether they belonged to the Royal Welsh or not, because it was rather peculiar. The day after we got in, first thing we looked for was food and drink, naturally. And we found there was about half a ton of spuds and about 200 dozen eggs in the cellar. That's all there was in the way of food. No bread. We hadn't had any bread for God knows how long. And well, we'd only been there, next morning, an army bloke come up and he says, have you got a bacon slicer? Yes, one down there, a bacon. No bacon, but it's a bacon slicer. I said, why? He said, I want to cut my bread up. Oh, bread, I said, could do some bread. We haven't had any bread. He said, you're not getting any either. He said, I've only got one loaf for everybody. He said, that's why I want to use the bacon slicer, so I can cut it up thin, wafer thin. I always remember that. Anyway, I was in that place, and we found there was a load of beer in there. The German beer wasn't all that clever, but even then we managed to get on. We also found that it was an open city for a curfew one for 48 hours when we got in. Nobody was allowed on the streets except for policemen and doctors. So we had quite a time shooting at people who appeared out. Our orders were, if we'd seen anybody, we shot at them, simple as that. But
did you do it?
Yeah, we fired at them. It didn't usually. They usually ran down the side streets. But basically speaking, there wasn't much happening anywhere because the place was pretty ruined. I mean, Amberg was a mess. I would say that at least 50% of it was flat, and I mean flat, I don't mean just ruined. And the other half, probably half of that was ruined, so it was pretty bad. And for a place as what, half again as big as Glasgow, you can understand there was a lot of rubble everywhere. It's on the streets, it was quite rough actually. But we'd been there a couple of days and caught this chap out after curfew, and we opened fire and he got in the gutter. We went and picked him up, and he was a Dutchman, young student. And he was jabbering away, he spoke quite good English actually. He said, "Do you want whiskey?" "Yeah, wouldn't mind, want whiskey?" Put on our leg, of course. "No, no," he said, "I know where there's whiskey."
Had he been shot?
What?
Had he been shot?
No, he hadn't been shot. He laid in a gutter. We didn't shoot people for the sake of doing it, but we had to, if they did run, or we just fired up behind him on the way. Anyway, he said, "I'll show you where there's whiskey." Took it as a pinch of salt, but come on then, never mind, let's see. Anyway, he took us among the ruins, and of course that's the brewery district of Ambergers of St. Pauli, and went to one of these buildings, pretty ruined, and went down a cellar, and sure enough, there were big vats of wine, and there was whiskey, probably about 24 bottles. He said, "This is what the Germans took at Dunkirk," or whether it was true or not, I don't know, but anyway, obviously it was a store they'd been using, so we went back with the whiskey, and what with the beer, we really enjoyed ourselves. But needless to say, the next thing he said, "Do you want women?" And he took us to what had been a school, a long block had been a school, and it was full of girls from all parts of Europe. All young girls had been slave labour. I don't suppose any of them much more to over about 25. And there was a different nationality in each floor. You'd enjoy yourself around Europe in a couple of hours if you wanted to. But we got these girls were pretty hungry, actually. They had been looked after, because that was where they stayed when they'd done the jobs in the various factories and that, where they worked. But, we took some of the wine round there, and we used to have a right old time until the army started filtering in, and they spoiled it then, because all the army blokes got in there, and we had a fight one night with the MPs fighting at each other, because the MPs had found out about this, had come in to clear the place out, and because the German police had reported it, I suppose. We didn't care less about German police, but what happened this particular night, they had these guns firing, Sten guns, one thing and another. Went down to find out, and I've got my Sten gun on my shoulder, because we always carried a gun, we always had to carry a gun, and I'm poking it round the doors. What the hell's going on? I thought, to tell you the truth, it was the German police, but the chap standing there, he said, "I wouldn't fight if I was you." He said, "Them are MPs out there." He said, "And some of the blokes are firing out the windows at them, you know." And so they had a bit of a battle. But anyway, I managed to get away from it all, because I could see what was going to happen. And then, of course, that place shut down rapidly. But there must have been a report got through, because we got drafted out of there. And I went up to the barracks down, and then I went to the Reichshof Hotel. The Reichshof Hotel was taken over by people who were working in the dockyard. A lot of them were officers, well, they weren't really officers, they were given officer rank. They were chief stevedores and architects and people like that. And they're given naval ranks. And the Reichshof Hotel was there where they lived, in the hotel. It was one of the few buildings around there that was standing. The Reichshof Hotel, you know, hadn't been touched. The bloke behind the counter was, call him a British agent if I like, but he'd been in contact with the British before, and he'd pulled out all the Nazis and one thing and another. Because he said, I was talking to one, he spoke very good English. He was a prisoner of war in the First World War back end. He said, "I kept telling everybody the waste of time fighting the British." He said, "I knew we'd get beat sooner or later if we fought the British." He said, "You bugger, you never give up." But he had a bit of a mutiny. He said, half the staff were Nazis, and they whipped them all out. It was interesting days then, because we weren't like to fraternise, but we did get involved with the Jews and one thing and another, and they were handing over the Germans or the Nazis all over the place, and black marketing was going on, and basically they were exciting days in a way. But the German population were really going through it, and that winter was a very, very cold winter, 1945 winter, and there was no coal or anything to start with before we started getting coal through on the trains. By the way, when they ran the trains, coal trains through, they used to put the coal into the canals in Hamburg, and there's like an island between the canals. They used to put the coal on there, so they stopped the Germans pinching it, you see. And when the coal trains come through, we used to, either the army or we used to do it at times, sit one each end with a rifle to shoot anybody who tried to. Used to jump off the bridges onto the coal train, shovel the coal off to pick it up later. And you'd have to shoot them.
Did you shoot them?
Fired at them, whether you hit them or not. They're quicker than that, used to jump off. But yeah, that, they don't really just risk the neck to get a bit of coal. I think it was very desperate that winter. And of course, it was so cold and lots of people died. They had to use dynamite to make mass graves in the local cemetery there. They had to dynamite the holes to bury people. It was so cold. It was a very cold winter. And we weren't all that well off, because most of we had lovely coats and things like that, fur-lined coats and helmets and that to keep us warm. But generally speaking, we had to wear mittens when we were writing a letter, you know, because you couldn't write a letter otherwise. It was pretty cold. But until I got organised, like, you know. But I stayed out in Germany until the end of 47.
Doing the same kind of thing?
Well, yes. Well, I went into the barracks. I was in the Reichshof Hotel for several months, and I got myself into trouble, so they put me in the barracks. Smoking on watch, that was. But I got myself into trouble, they put me in the barracks, and I was doing, lots of people got demobbed at that time. You can well imagine, everybody was disappearing. And we only left a few, wasn't it? We had this huge barracks. It was quite a big barracks. When you consider that the front of it, we were up against a railway line, and Alsterdorf station was there. The other end of the barracks was the next station down, an electric steel. So you can imagine, it was quite a huge place. And it had big, well, there'd been tanks, been Panzer. They had these big workshops and these big garages, you know, where the tanks were. So they turned that into an Affy bulk store for Northwest Germany. And we really enjoyed ourselves, because I told you before that a lot of our people were pretty wide characters. I cleared them out of jails and that, so we had some pretty wide characters. And the first thing one chap had done when it went into the barracks, the officers had stayed behind, sent in some of the lads to make sure, sort the place out. And he went straight in, and the first thing he did was got a bunch of keys and put them in his pocket, you see. Because when they went in, they found a second bunch, and they didn't realise that we had the duplicate keys for every place in the camp. So when they made the Naffy Bulk stores, all we had to do was unlock the door, walk in and out when we felt like it. So you can imagine what it was like, particularly when they had whiskey and all sorts in there, because it wasn't just the Naffy for the camp, it was Naffy for all of that area. So, we had some pretty rough characters moving this around. While we were there, one of the first things we'd done, that was rather amusing, the army barracks, the German army barracks, they used to have a fence about that high. They used to trust the people for going in and out. If you're in the German army, as far as I could make out, if you went there for duty, you really got clobbered. Other than that, you were free to walk in and out when you felt like out the barracks. Certainly, the barracks I've seen only had very low railings. First thing we did was put barbed wire up about 12 foot high at Strutson, which was supposed to keep the Germans out. In actual fact, it was to keep us in. But we made sure we made parts of the barbed wire, because we had German working, well, we had DPs to start with, working parties. We made sure that we left gaps where we could get out, so we could walk out the barbed wire without any too much trouble at all, really. It was a bit of a laugh. But as people got demobbed, it only left a few of us there. And, I was a naval seaman there, and I was in charge of the laundry. I was chief fireman. I was also a gunner's yeoman. I had about half a dozen different jobs. And while we were there, they tried all the naval officers in our camp. We built a courthouse in the camp. And all the naval officers, by the way, they were in the in what had been, just outside of Hamburg, there was a detention camp, what you call it, a German...
Concentration.
That's right, they put them in there. So we dealt, they all had to be denazified, all these people. And we used to go along and bring them in a few at a time, and we used to try them. And it was very interesting when they had that detail, because you could stand at the back of the court and hear what went on. And the surprise of what we knew about every U-boat and every ship. We knew so much. No good them turning around saying they didn't do this, didn't do that. We knew. And generally speaking, it wasn't too much in the way of atrocities went on at sea, you know. Not a lot, really, for the Germans. There was some that machine gunned people in the waters and didn't pick people up, although not picking people up after a U-boat has sunk so many ships is quite understandable. They had nowhere to put them anyway, so, you know. But generally speaking, there was only a few of them were really nasty characters. I think the Navy was far more gentlemanly than the Army, the German Army, you know. But except for some of the younger U-boat folks were a bit, you know, awkward, but generally speaking. But I had to get all the material to build all that. I had to take German wagons down to Hanover to get glass, or way down to get pipes and bricks. I had to have bricks come up the canal in these barges, which take about 20,000 ton, believe it or not, huge barges full of bricks, and get the bricks to the barracks. And we had all sorts of jobs. Plus the fact is, while we were there, you know, those Jewish ships come in there. Remember the Jewish ships that went all the way around the world? The,
To go to Palestine.
That's right. They finished up in Hamburg. And they put them in a concentration camp. They weren't very happy, I tell you. You had quite a job getting them off the ships.
Did you have to do that?
No, what we had to do, we had boats on the river to make sure anybody jumped over the side, we collect them in. But they had paratroopers doing that. And they had a pretty rough time with it because they had all the press of the world around there as well. It really restricted them. The paratroopers had a hard time, I can tell you that, because they didn't go, they couldn't get them off the ships easily. And they weren't allowed to abuse them because of all the world's press being around there. But they got them all off at the end. But while we were there, and a lot of people don't realise this, there was lots of work to be done, not only to get everything moving and going. We opened up the Blumenvoss, we opened up most of the factories. But the thing was, one of the things that struck me, I think there was something like 9 million displaced persons in Germany. And all those people had to go back to where they belonged. Well, you couldn't just let them walk back. And what they'd done, they had a system of where they used to run trains from, say, Hamburg, Hanover, round from Berlin and round in a circle. And they used to pile these people on the train. And as it went round, they'd stop here and they'd have people who had all the information on them, and then they'd be dispersed. And this went on for quite a long time. And on a night, wherever they stopped, like, for instance, in Hamburg, stop at Bahnhof, that was dead opposite the hotel where I was, there was these big, huge bunkers, German airshells, bunkers we called them. They used to bung them all down there, give them a meal, put them on the train next day, and away they went again. And they gradually dispersed something like 9 million people. It was a fantastic job, really, when you consider. A lot of people don't realise the amount of work there was in Germany after the war. When you consider that practically every town had an army major or an army captain as mayor. I mean, these people had never done the job before.
How did you personally get on with German people?
Very good, actually. Obviously, he was the old bull. None of them were Nazi. They all said that anyway. We didn't take too much notice of that. Generally speaking, yes. What I did like about the Germans was, they cleared up. They helped to clear up their own situation, voluntary. You didn't have to tell them. There were only two places. Now, we had another job, which we had to clear the mines out the Elbe, you know, before we could get ships in. So the first thing we done when we got in there was found the German Minesweeper Association, and they're voluntary. Come and we had put matlows on the boats for them and the sweepers, and they actually cleared the mines in the Elbe. But they were very helpful. It was their own country. I think a lot of them realised they had to get back on their feet again. But they were very good like that. It didn't take them long to clear the rubble off the roads and pile it up on the side and all that lot. And they were doing it in a spare time. Of course, a lot of them never had jobs anyhow. And don't forget, there was very few young people there then. They were all at the front. It was quite a few months before the youngsters started coming back. And that's when we started having a bit of trouble with them. But before that, they were the older men and mostly women.
What was the trouble you had when the youngsters started to come back?
Well, naturally, the blokes had When we first went there, there was fraternisation ban on. Now, that was not taken too much notice of, but it was to a certain extent. When blokes got in with the girls, and they had the girlfriends, and what they're going to, of course, when the young people come back, they resented it. It was simple as that. So we used to have a few scraps here and there, you know. That's how I got my eye cut there. I got a cut above my eye in one of those little bundles.
Can you tell me what happened when your eye was cut?
Well, we were in this bar behind, just the back of the barracks where I was, and it was to do with women, I think, and a fight started. Well, we were used to this kind of fight, because, funny enough, we